Welcome to According to Sam, folks. This is episode 209. Thank you so much for tuning in, for watching and listening. I hope you had a great weekend. I'm sure you've noticed, especially last week and over the weekend and pretty much all year, the protests that have been going on college campuses, but not only at college campuses. You've been having situations where traffic has been blocked. They were protesting at the correspondence dinner last week, and they're all protesting for Gaza, for the people of Gaza. Some of the protests are completely anti-Israel. You know, all this started back in October with the, it was a massacre pretty much that happened in Israel on October 7th when Hamas paraglided over the fence and they had tunnels that went underneath the fence and they stormed into Israel and killed a bunch of people, took a bunch of hostages, and this has been going on since October. And the protests in the United States, because Israel responded and Israel has been heavy-handed in their response. And there's been protests going on the college campuses all over this country, not only at the college campuses or on the college campuses, again, everywhere. And now we're getting into the summer. People are starting to say this is reminiscent of what happened in 2020 with the protests all summer in 2020 for George Floyd. If you remember, that happened and started in the month of May, and we're now in the month of May. It was towards the end of May when the video of George Floyd's death went viral. It's around May 31st when they started protesting. And it went on all summer. We all remember. So people are thinking that this could go on. The protests for Gaza could go on all summer and into the Democratic convention in August, which is in Chicago, Illinois. And people are relating it back to the 1968 convention, which was in Chicago, Illinois, and there were riots there because of the Vietnam War, and Richard Nixon ends up winning that election, and Bernie Sanders even came out and says that this war in Gaza and in Israel could be Joe Biden's Vietnam, is what Bernie Sanders said. So there's people making that relationship. So today, I wanted to talk about that more broadly and talk about the protests, talk about what the political effects, because we are in an election year, what they could be. But this morning, we found out that Israel is getting ready to move into Gaza, and they're getting ready to attack the city of Rafah. Now, they've been talking about this for a while. This is where Hamas is their stronghold, where they believe that Hamas is the majority of the fighters are set up in Rafah. And now Israel, today's Monday. We had all those protests in the college campuses last week. Joe Biden even came out and spoke on it a little bit late, but he did come out and speak on it because people were telling them that politically this is bad for you, Joe Biden. So he had to come out and say something. And then today, we learned that Israel is finally about to move into Rafah. And I want you to take a listen to this report.
Breaking news concerning the Israel-Hamas war. President Biden just finished a call with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Biden just finished a call with Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, this is the phone call that they want the public to know about. They're publicly announcing this phone call that Joe Biden just got off of with Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel today. But let's listen to the report, and I'm going to tell you what I believe is going on here.
Breaking news concerning the Israel-Hamas war. President Biden just finished a call with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. According to an Israeli official, they spoke just hours after Israel ordered about 100,000 people to evacuate from eastern Rafah. This was the scene inside Rafah earlier today, showing families packing up and leaving. The evacuation order comes as Israeli officials vowed to carry out an operation in the city. The announcement complicating already fraught negotiations for a ceasefire deal, but two regional sources tell NBC News the talks have not completely collapsed. Joining us now from Tel Aviv, NBC's Raf Sanchez. Raf, what's the very latest? This situation seems to be getting more and more difficult and dangerous.
This is an extremely critical moment, Jose, in this long war, in these long negotiations. As you said, President Biden just a short while ago wrapping up that phone call with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The White House has been saying for months that it opposes a large-scale Israeli ground operation in the city of Rafah, where more than a million Palestinian civilians are sheltering. But now, Jose, we have the first tangible signs on the ground that that operation may be beginning. Earlier on today, Israeli aircraft dropping leaflets over eastern Rafah with a stark message to Palestinian civilians: get out. We are about to attack this area.
So very important lot that he says there. The first thing that he says that I want to point your attention to is that he says that the Biden administration has been against an invasion of Rafah. The Biden administration has been telling Netanyahu and Israel, we don't want you to go into Rafah. As a matter of fact, in an interview a couple of weeks ago, Biden, he says, you know, that, what does he say? He doesn't say Rafah. He says Haifa, which Haifa is a city in Israel. And Biden basically says in the interview, this is on the 18th of April, so it's just a couple of weeks ago.
And I made it clear to Israelis, don't move on Haifa.
Haifa.
It's just not, I mean.
So Haifa, Haifa is in Israel. So he made a mistake there. I make mistakes on this podcast all the time and misspeak. But he says that he told Netanyahu not to invade Haifa. Haifa is in Israel. Obviously, Netanyahu's not going to invade Haifa. So what Biden meant here was Rafah, that he's been telling Netanyahu not to invade Rafah. But then we had all those protests last week. That, I mean, they took the media attention away from the Trump trials. They took the media attention away from everything. Everything was taken out of the media because of these protests at these college campuses. These protests are growing. They're calling him Genocide Joe everywhere he goes. I mean, how can this guy's running for re-election where people, and again, Bernie Sanders is relating this to 1968. The convention again is in Chicago this year. Bernie Sanders is saying this could be your Vietnam, Joe Biden. So all those protests, all the bad press, Joe Biden had to come out and speak. And then on Monday morning, the Monday morning after all of the chaos that was going on the college campuses and protests all last week and over the weekend at commencement ceremonies on Monday morning, this morning, Israel decides that they're going to start dropping leaflets and they're going into Rafah, and they're reporting this phone call that, you know, coming from Israeli sources. That's how we know about the phone call. This phone call where Biden called Netanyahu and they're talking about this invasion of Rafah. What I believe happened is Joe Biden and his Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, got on the phone with Netanyahu this weekend. And it may have been yesterday, it may have been Saturday, but that's the phone call they're not telling you about. And publicly, this guy's saying, you know, don't invade Haifa, Rafah. Publicly, he's saying that he's telling Netanyahu not to go in and invade in Gaza. But I think that this guy had a, this is what I believe, there's no evidence of this, no one's reporting on this, but I believe that Joe Biden, his administration, got on the phone after those protests and everything. The political risk to Joe Biden is of such that he needs Israel to go in and finish the job right away. And I believe that Joe Biden communicated that to Netanyahu, that look, time's to go. It's time to go now. Go in, finish the job. We can't have this going on all summer. They're calling me Genocide Joe at my rallies, for God's sake. I can't go anywhere without these people protesting me. This is going to bring me down in November. Go in and finish the job. So he's saying publicly, no, don't invade Haifa, don't invade Rafah. But privately, I believe he got on the phone with Netanyahu and told him, look, you need to go in. You need to go finish this job because this is hurting me politically. And I believe that is why this morning that Israel, the IDF, started dropping leaflets in Rafah, telling people to get out because they're getting ready to go in and finish the job because Joe Biden needs them to finish the job ASAP because this is a political drain on Joe Biden.
Breaking news concerning the Israel-Hamas war. President Biden just finished a call with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. According to an Israeli official, they spoke just hours after Israel ordered about 100,000 people to evacuate from eastern Rafah. This was the scene inside Rafah earlier today, showing families packing up and leaving. The evacuation order comes as Israeli officials vowed to carry out an operation in the city.
So as soon as possible, Joe Biden wants him to carry out this operation as soon as possible and get this over with. I promise you. So Israel starts dropping leaflets this morning, warning people in Rafah to get out. We're getting ready to come in. And then Hamas has been holding up a ceasefire negotiation for weeks. They've been trying to get Hamas to agree to a ceasefire after the IDF starts dropping leaflets in Rafah saying that, look, we're getting ready to come in. Then Hamas says, okay, we agree to ceasefire. It's a clown show. It's a clown show. So this is the show that I wanted to do today. I wanted to talk about the protest. I wanted to talk about the political threats to Joe Biden and what these protests mean politically if they continue out through the summer and into the fall. I wanted to talk about all of that in this podcast, but I'm not going to do that podcast. In this podcast, with the remainder of the time that I have, about 30 minutes, because I want to leave myself about 20 minutes to get into that article from the last podcast that I didn't get to read. But I want to get back into the topic that we were talking about in the last podcast. Now, we were talking about psychiatry, and we were talking about the pharmaceutical industry, selling everyone drugs to achieve a mental peace that people are seeking today. People are dealing with anxiety. They're dealing with depression. They're dealing with all of these emotional, behavioral, and psychological issues. And the pharmaceutical companies are selling us SSRIs, serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and other drugs. I mean, and the numbers. If I have time, I'm going to get into some of these numbers. About how and if you look at the countries that are using these drugs, the majority of these drugs, they're all Western countries. They're all in Europe, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Very few African countries are on these. I thought that was interesting. Okay. Very few countries in South America have high numbers of people using these drugs. Very few countries in Asia have high amounts of people using these drugs. But it seems like that there is an epidemic of mental illness right now, and it's only in Western countries. So we were talking about that in the last podcast, and what sparked that conversation was these comments that John MacArthur made that went viral last week. I want to play them again, and I want to get back into what we were talking about in the last podcast. And then on Friday, we'll pick up and talk about these protests and what's going on in Israel and in Gaza. Here's John MacArthur.
There's no such thing as PTSD. There's no such thing as OCD. There's no such thing as ADHD. Those are noble lies. To basically give the excuse to, in the end of the day, to medicate people. And Big Pharma's in charge of a lot of that.
Big Pharma's in charge of a lot of that. Big Pharma's in charge of a lot of that for sure. So we were talking about the Humanist Manifesto 1 in the last podcast, signed in 1933 by John Dewey, Charles Francis Potter, and many more people. And I was explaining these first three statements in the Humanist Manifesto and how these three statements together outline a materialistic worldview. They outline what is known as materialism. And I was explaining how these principles were part of the foundations of modern education, the modern education system that was set up by John Dewey, and Rockefeller funded it. And they wanted to, if you would have asked the question of if people believed in that they had a soul or if they were a spirit in 1933, the majority of the country would have said, yes, I believe in dualism. I believe in duality. I believe that I have a soul. I believe that I have a spirit. But they took these principles, the principles of materialism, and injected them into public education and have done so for decades, to where now the majority of our culture, the majority of our society has a materialistic worldview. The majority of our society believes, as religious humanists believe here in the first statement, regard the universe as self-existent and not created. Now, the funny thing about this is that this document was composed and signed in 1933. This is before the atom is split. This is before the genome is mapped. I mean, we didn't know anything about microbiology and DNA in 1933, and they're making statements like this. We didn't know, as far as cosmology goes, we didn't know anything about, or we knew about cosmology, but we didn't know the things, nearly the things that we know today about cosmology and physics. But these are the statements. Religious humanists regard the universe as self-existent, not created. Religious humanists believe that man is a part of nature and that he has emerged as a result of a continuous process. And then the third one, in holding this organic view of life, humanists find that the traditional dualism of mind and body must be rejected. So if you're rejecting your soul, if you're rejecting the dualism of mind and body, and we really do have a soul, then you're rejecting a part of your makeup. You're rejecting a part of who you are just because it's not material. And then if you do that and you create a society that is only focused on the material world and has a material worldview, the only thing that can sustain that society, The only thing that that society chases after and desires are materialistic things. That's why you have such a materialistic society, because our society believes these three principles, which science now, even science is proving that these are not true. So we talked about that in the last podcast, and we talked about Sigmund Freud, particularly his theory of the id, ego, and the superego. And I was relating Sigmund Freud's theory of the subconscious and the id, ego, and the superego to what Paul lays out in his epistles, beginning in Romans. And I was relating, Paul talks about the flesh and the spirit. I was relating the flesh to the id, to and then the spirit to the superego, and then the soul, the mind, is the ego. Paul talks about that beginning in the book of Romans, but through all of the epistles, he continues this theme of the flesh, the carnal man, the man that is only interested in carnal things, material things. That's like if you know the Dave Matthews song, Dancing Nancy's, eat, drink, and be merry because tomorrow we die. If you believe in a materialistic universe and you believe that you're only organic human that came about from a natural process, there is no creator, there's only the material universe, then eat, drink, be merry because tomorrow you die makes sense. But Paul says, again, the verse in chapter 14 that we read in the last podcast, for the kingdom of heaven is not eating and drinking, but righteousness, peace, and joy in the Holy Ghost, that there's something else. If we are more than just physical beings, then there's something else that needs to sustain us outside of just physical substance or sustenance, the eating and drinking, that there's something else that we need to satisfy us. And because they took away the spirit in teaching us this worldview of materialism, that is why we're not satisfied. That's why we're not sustained, because we don't even believe we have a soul. So we were talking about Sigmund Freud. I want to, at a future date, I don't have time in this podcast, but I want to introduce you guys real briefly to Sigmund Freud's nephew. Sigmund Freud's wife was named Martha Bernays, and Martha Bernays's nephew through her brother is Edward Bernays. Edward Bernays, he basically handled all of the propaganda for the United States military in World War I. He traveled with Woodrow Wilson to France to negotiate the Treaty of Versailles. And then he came back to the United States after World War I, and he set up the Office of Public Relations. And he explains in this movie, and one of these days I'm going to take you through this movie, very, very important movie, even before I take you through it. If you've never seen The Century of the Self, it's a four-part documentary. You can watch it on YouTube, but it's all about Sigmund Freud's theory of the subconscious and how his nephew, Edward Bernays, took his theory of the subconscious and used it for public relations, used it to sell propaganda to the American people. Play a little bit of the first episode of Century of the Self. Just take a listen.
A new theory about human nature was put forward by Sigmund Freud. He had discovered, he said, primitive sexual and aggressive forces hidden deep inside the minds of all human beings. Forces which, if not controlled, led individuals and societies to chaos and destruction. This series is about how those in power have used Freud's theories to try and control the dangerous crowd in an age of mass democracy.
How those in power have used Freud's analysis to control the people is what this documentary is about.
At the heart of the story is not just Sigmund Freud, but other members of the Freud family.
When Whippoorwill calls.
This episode is about Freud's American nephew, Edward Bernays. Bernays is almost completely unknown today, but his influence on the 20th century was nearly as great as his uncle's.
Both of them together, their influence on the 20th century and now even the 21st century is... one of these days I'm going to take you through that. But this lady goes through, I want to go back into relating Freud's theory of the id, ego, and superego to what Paul says in the Bible about the body, the soul, and the spirit. Body being flesh, the flesh, the soul, and the spirit is the three parts that Paul says, and then the three parts that Freud says are the id, ego, and the superego. I want to show you more about how they relate. Now, again, the id relates to the flesh. The flesh is carnal. The flesh only cares about carnal desires because the flesh is only about the materialistic world. The flesh only wants to... So everything that she says here about the id is what Paul says about the flesh. Take a listen.
According to Sigmund Freud's psychoanalytic theory, the human personality is made up of three parts: the id, the ego, and the superego. The id. The id is present at birth and is the seat of all emotional impulses and desires.
The id is present at birth. This goes directly to the Christian theory of original sin. That the id is present at birth. The superego is not present at birth, and the superego is not guiding you at birth. This is so biblical. This is at the roots of what Christianity teaches, is that there is no superego. There is no spiritual influence on you when you're born. Only the id is pulling on you. Only the id influences you. Base level desires, base level needs, base level lusts and whatever the flesh craves. Hedonism is what it's talking about here. Just what she's going to tell you here. What the id is based on is what Freud calls the pleasure principle. That the only thing you care, and this is what the hedonist. The only thing the hedonist cares about is pleasing his flesh, pleasing his body, pleasure. So that's what the id is. That's what she's explaining.
Id is present at birth and is the seat of all emotional impulses and desires, especially your sexual and aggressive urges. Freud viewed the id as a cauldron full of seething emotions, which knows no judgments or values.
No values.
It is illogical, immoral.
The id is illogical and immoral.
Freud viewed the id as a cauldron full of seething emotions, which knows no judgments or values. The id is illogical, immoral, and driven to satisfy instinctual needs. Children younger than 2 years old are completely dominated by the id. For example, when Charlie wants
some adults, she's talking about children. But there's a lot of adults that are completely driven by the id as well.
The id. For example, when Charlie wants something, he wants it now. He expresses his emotions directly and spontaneously. He kicks, he bites, he screams and cries. The id obeys what Freud called the pleasure principle. So the primary motive is pleasure and immediate gratification of needs.
To the flesh. Pleasure. An immediate gratification of the flesh, what Paul calls over and over again, the carnal body, the carnal man. That is what the id corresponds to.
It pays no attention to the demands of reality or morality. Its motto is, if it feels good, do it.
If it feels good, do it. That's the id. If it feels good, do it. And what Paul says is that's the flesh as well. That the flesh is, if it feels good, do it. Now, we read this passage of scripture from Paul in the last podcast. This is Romans 8, verse 5. And then I substituted the word flesh for id in this passage, and the word spirit for superego, because I'm relating it back to Freud's theory. And again, let's read it the same way. Those who live according to the id have their minds set on what the id desires. And what does the id desire? She tells you right here, the id desires, what does the id desire? If it feels good.
Its motto is, if it feels good, do it.
That's what the id desires. If it feels good, do it. So this is what Paul says. Those who live according to the id have their minds set on what the id desires. If it feels good, do it. If it feels good to the flesh, do it. But those who live according to the spirit, the superego, have their minds set on what the superego, what the spirit desires. The mind governed by the flesh, the id, is death. But the mind governed by the spirit, the superego, is peace. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about inner peace, mental peace, what the drug companies are telling you you need to pop a pill to get. Paul's telling you how to get it without a pill. The mind governed by the flesh is hostile to God and does not submit. The hedonistic mind that is only concerned with eat, drink, and be merry because tomorrow we die. That's only concerned with if it feels good, do it. If it's only concerned with the pleasure principle and pleasing the flesh, Paul says the mind that is governed by the id is hostile to God and does not submit to God's law, nor can it do so. Those who are in the realm of the flesh, carnal, base level, id, cannot please God. All right, so now she goes into the superego. Now, the superego corresponds to what Paul calls the spirit, all right?
The impulses of the id are largely unconscious, meaning they're hidden from awareness. The ego.
Oh, she's going
the
to the ego.
The ego strives to manage.
So the ego's mind, I want her to, here, she's, I want you to hear her talk about the superego.
The superego. The superego usually develops when you are around 5 years old. It contains the rules and standards you absorbed from your parents, culture, so, teachers, religion, and society.
I think this is very interesting that she's saying that the superego develops around 5 years old. I don't know how you can say that. I mean, at what period? I mean, some people never develop a superego because, as John Locke says, tabula rasa, we're born with a blank slate. If you don't have anyone or anything that is imparting the morality of the superego in you at a young age, you have no, I mean, where would you get that morality from? So I don't know. I mean, 5 years old, it could be, you know, into adulthood for some people before. And some people never develop a superego, a spiritual conscious. Some people stay in hedonism and stay in the pleasure principle for their entire lives because they are confound to the four dimensions of space-time. That's what materialism is that there's nothing outside of the four dimensions of space-time. The three spatial dimensions and time. So those who believe in a spiritual realm believe that there's more than just the four dimensions of space-time. All right, back to the superego.
The superego. The superego usually develops when you are around 5 years old. It contains the rules and standards you absorbed from your parents, culture, teachers, religion, and society. It's basically your inner judge or critic. The function of the superego is to contain the demands of the id through moral influence of the ego. For example, when Michael was shopping, he felt the urge to steal a chocolate bar. However, his superego reminded him that stealing is morally wrong. The morality principle is a basis of the superego, so it's very focused on what is good or bad and right or wrong. It represents the traditional values and ideals of society as they're handed down from parents to children. If a strong moral code is not sufficiently sustained, then guilt is produced by the superego. Defense mechanism.
If the, I like what she says there at the end.
If a strong moral code is not sufficiently sustained, then guilt is produced by the superego.
If a strong moral code is not sustained, then guilt is produced by the superego. And you have to have that moral code, whether it comes from your parents or from your religion, your faith. Back to Paul, that's what Paul is talking about here. He says, that the Spirit comes from God, that God is giving you that moral code. It's not innate, it's learned, back to Locke and tabula rasa, but it's learned from your parents. And sometimes it's not even, there's people like Russell Brand who just got baptized as an adult. I don't know where the influence of that morality came from, but he's made that change as an adult. So again, it doesn't necessarily have to come from your parents. And this is not Freud's theory, and what Paul is talking about in the Bible are not a perfect match, but they it relates enough where you can use Freud's theory to as an example to show what Paul is talking about in his epistles. One of Paul's epistles, his letter to the church at Galatia, this is the fifth chapter of Galatians and the 16th verse, and Paul in this epistle gives some characteristics of the flesh, the carnal man, and the spirit, what he refers to as the fruits of the spirit. So the acts of the flesh, the acts of the id, and the fruits of the spirit, the fruits of the superego, this moral conscience that pulls on the ego, on the mind, to get the mind to do what is right, do what is moral, do what is prudent, and the id, which only wants to fulfill the pleasure principle and the pleasures of the flesh. So Paul says here, so I say walk by the Spirit, walk by the superego. What is he saying here? He's saying that on a daily basis, keep your mind. There's this story, it's an old Native American story about two wolves. Forget what movie this was in, but it's an old story, but they told this story in a movie about the two wolves that live inside of an individual. And one wolf is really bad and wants you to, again, fulfill the pleasure principle, the flesh. And then there's one wolf that represents the superego, the morality, the things that would force you or to guide you into doing what is right. And the story is, which one of the wolves are going to have more influence? And the answer is the one that you feed. So if you feed the id, then the id is going to have more influence over your body. And if you feed the superego, then the superego is going to have more influence over your body. So that's what Paul is talking about here. If you feed the Spirit, then the Spirit is going to have more influence over your mind. And if you feed the id, if you feed the flesh, the carnal man, through the pleasure principle, then that pleasure principle, the id, is going to have more control over your mind. So Paul is saying here, I say, walk by the Spirit and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. Walk by the superego, and you will not gratify the desires of the id. For the id craves what is contrary to the Spirit. The id craves what is contrary to the Spirit. That's what this woman says here. that they're contrary to one another. The id and the superego are contrary. The spirit and the flesh are contrary to one another. For the flesh, the id, craves what is contrary to the spirit, and the spirit what is contrary to the flesh. They are opposite to each other, so that you do not do what you want. But if you are led by the spirit, by the superego, you are not under the law. All right, so the 19th chapter, he says, the acts of the flesh. So these are the characteristics of the flesh that Paul is. And now you tell me if these characteristics match what this woman explained about the id, the characteristics I'm getting ready to read to you, the pleasure principle. If it feels good, do it. This is what Paul says that the acts of the flesh are: sexual immorality, impurity, debauchery, idolatry, sorcery. Now, this one is really interesting. Sorcery. Why is this interesting? Because if you remember the podcast that I did at the beginning of the year when I started this new podcast, we were talking about witchcraft. And I was explaining to you the Greek word that is used in this passage right here. The Greek word that Paul uses is this word, pharmakeia. Pharmakeia is where we get the word pharmacy, pharmaceuticals, big pharma that John MacArthur was talking about here. Big pharma. Pharmakeia means sorcery. That's the word. That's the Greek word. The definition, the use of medicine, drugs, or spells, magic, sorceries, pharmakeia. I just thought that was interesting because Paul is laying out that sorcery, pharmakeia, is works of the flesh. Sexual immorality, impurity, debauchery, adultery, sorcery, hatred, discord, jealousy, rage, rivalries, divisions, factions, envy, drunkenness, orgies, and all alike. I warn you, as I did before, those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. And then he goes into what the characteristics, what he calls the fruits of the spirit. The spirit, again, corresponds to the superego. This is your morality. This is where you get all of the things that lead you to do the right thing. Again, the kingdom of heaven is not eating and drinking, but righteousness, peace, and joy in the Holy Ghost. So the things that lead you into that, Paul says the acts of the fruits of the Spirit are love, joy, peace. There's peace again, patience, right? You don't have anxiety if you have patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such things, there are no law. And then this last, let's read these last three verses. Those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. Passions and desires. The flesh, passions and desires. If it feels good, do it. Those who belong to Christ, and this goes back to that concept that I was telling you in the last podcast that is repeated over and over again in the Bible, and this is a very important Christian concept, is the idea of the new man, that you are born again by the renewing of your mind. So those who belong to Jesus Christ have crucified the flesh and its passions and desires. Since we live by the Spirit and walk in step with the Spirit, let us not become conceited, provoking, and envy of one another. Conceited, provoking, or envy. So we talked about, we played this clip in the last podcast of Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins is, he's one of the most esteemed atheists in the intellectual atheistic community. He's written tons of books espousing atheism. He is an Oxford professor, Englishman, and he hates God, but he's a cultural Christian and he doesn't want Islam to, and he's noticing that Islam is taking over England and that more mosques are being built. And he's basically lamenting that in this interview. We played this in the last podcast. Let's play a little bit more of it again.
It's true that statistically the number of people who actually believe in Christianity is going down. And I'm happy with that. But I would not be happy if, for example, we lost all our cathedrals and our beautiful parish churches. So I count myself a cultural Christian. I think it would matter if we, certainly if we substituted any alternative religion, that would be truly dreadful.
Well, which brings me to my supplementary point, which is that, as we know, church attendance is plummeting. But the building, the erection of mosques across Europe, I think 6,000 are under construction and there are many more, I mean, are being planned. So do you think, do you regard that as a problem? Do you think that matters?
Yes, I do, really. I mean, I have to choose my words carefully. I mean, if I had to choose between Christianity and Islam, I'd choose Christianity every single time.
Well, nature abhors a vacuum, Mr. Dawkins, and I don't know where you think the cathedrals and the hymns and all the good things that you appreciate about Christianity comes from, but it comes from people who believe. So if you don't have people that believe, then you're not going to have the hymns, you're not going to have the cathedrals, and nature abhors a vacuum. So this guy talks in complete circles, but I was thinking about this and what he's saying, and you remember the clips that I was playing about Vladimir Putin, how Vladimir Putin has been making statements about returning Russia to the time of the czars. People, you know, keep saying that Russia wants to, Putin wants to take Russia back to the USSR and to communist Russia. Nothing could be further from the truth. You listen to what Putin is saying, he wants to take Russia back to the period of the czars, when Russia was a Christian nation, and he has espoused everything that Dawkins is saying there. And I kind of believe this about Trump too. I think that Trump and Putin, they really appreciate the world that they grew up in that was based on a Christian foundation. They understand the benefits of growing up in that world, and they're lamenting the loss of that world because they understand that that nature abhors a vacuum, and they can see what's going on. Now, do Trump and Putin, are they really believers? I don't know that I necessarily believe that. I mean, judging from some things that Putin said in that interview, particularly with Tucker Carlson, some things that Trump, I don't know that they are true believers, but I think that they believe what Richard Dawkins believes here, and that's why they want to return back to the time of the czars. And Trump's talking about how we need to bring religion back into our culture because they're lamenting what they see as a regression in the West because we are departing away from the Christian roots. This gentleman, Stephen Meyer, now he is kind of the anti Stephen Hawkins, Stephen Dawkins. Stephen Meyer is an intellectual scientist, has written tons of books, and he's written books, and he goes out and he debates on the opposite side of Richard Dawkins. Now, I don't think they've ever debated each other. I would love to see that, but Meyer has a new book out where he's focusing on cosmology and explaining why the existence of God is more probable than improbable because of things like the strong anthropic principle. He talks about the habitable zone, the Goldilocks zones of planets, the Big Bang, and more physics and cosmology. But he has written books about microbiology and other reasons for there being a higher probability that there is a God than there isn't a God. He was on Piers Morgan last week, and they got into a really great discussion about materialism. I want you to listen to a little bit of Stephen Meyer.
Sorry about your mother.
Oh, I shouldn't have introduced a personal element like that. But
I'm glad you did, because actually it does play into what you just said. Did that whole experience of losing your mother, did it change any of your thinking about any of this?
I think the experience of grief was something that was unexpected in how intense it was. She had dementia and had been in decline for several years. You think you're prepared when you're losing someone by degrees, but there's a finality of death that I think overtakes all of us in that moment of grief. And there's something about the grief experience that it seems to make everything else pale to insignificance in that moment. And I think it's kind of, my own view of it is this kind of a signal. Like your conscience tells you what's right and wrong. I think grief is telling you about what's really important, and that in that instance, what was important is that we had lost a person of eternal value. And so, I think it was you're never really prepared for the loss of a parent, and I thought I was, but I wasn't.
Do you take comfort because of your religious conviction that you'll see your mother again in an afterlife?
I absolutely do, yeah. And I think... when I was on the Rogan program, he was probing about both the objective evidence for belief in God and my subjective experience. And I would never base an argument to another scientist or philosopher on my subjective experience. But I think belief in God has, I think, legitimate objective and subjective basis. And I think that mysterious moment when you see a loved one passing, when the body is there, but the person is gone, it raises some profound metaphysical questions, or maybe a metaphysical awareness that there is something more than the material.
The body is there, but the person is gone. That statement itself goes back to this statement of dualism. In holding the organic view of life, humanists find that the traditional dualism of mind and body must be rejected. So what Dr. Meyer is saying here is that his mother had passed away, And the body is there in front of you. I'm looking at the body, but she's not there. She's gone. What the humanist would say is that she is her body, and that she's just dead. Eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow we die.
Is part of all of us.
So in a way, what you went through with your mother may have actually intensified your own belief in your theory about all this.
Yeah, sure.
Because
you
felt it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You see, that's where whenever I argue with atheists, I'm always struck by their refusal to go there into stuff like that. And yet they must themselves, through their own life experiences, have moments and experiences which must test their own conviction that there is nothing else.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a both-and thing if you're a believer. There's plenty of good, solid scientific evidence, good philosophical reasons for belief. But then there are these experiences, too, that we have along the way that suggest it's not just matter in motion. You know, there's more to the world than the material stuff.
When you hear someone like Richard Dawkins, when he's so emphatic that he's right, and you know, believing in gods like believing in fairies and all this kind of thing, do you respect that, or do you think it's just performative?
He signed a book for me once in a line. You know, I've never met him, but when I watched the interview you did with him, and I honestly, there's something about the guy. I love the guy. He's so intense.
So they're talking about Richard Dawkins, that's who they're talking about here. He says he's never met him, but that's what Piers Morgan had done an interview with Richard Dawkins before this interview. So that's what they're talking about here.
God's like believing in fairies and all this kind of thing. Do you respect that, or do you think it's just performative?
He signed a book for me once in a line. You know, I've never met him. But when I watched the interview you did with him, and I honestly, there's something about the guy. I love the guy. He's so intense about
it. He was quite rude about me afterwards. I don't know why. I really quite enjoyed the interview.
It looked like you were having fun.
Yeah, I didn't think it was a problem. He clearly thought there was.
But I always feel that anyone who has that level of intensity about the big questions in life is someone with whom I share a kindred spirit. Now, we're in the opposite. We've come to the opposite conclusion. But I also think he has this great talent for framing issues. You know, the universe we observe has exactly the properties we should expect. That's a great quote. If no design, no purpose. Another one, he says that biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. And yet, Dawkins himself acknowledges that he can't explain the origin of the first life.
Right.
So,
and that to me, right there, His inability to do that is where his whole position to me collapses. Because if you're going to just make assumptions that another person's view is completely wrong, there cannot be a God, well, okay, fine. But you've got to be able to explain.
You got to deliver the goods.
Yes.
In the interview with you, it was so telling. When you asked him what he wished he knew and could explain, he said, the origin of the universe, the origin of life, and the nature of consciousness.
Yeah.
Well, those are the very things that materialism, it's not just that science can't explain those, a materialistic worldview fails to explain.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen to what he says here. This goes back to the Humanist Manifesto. The origin of the universe, the origin of mankind, and the origin of consciousness. It's right there. That the humanists have taught you, this is how you have a materialistic worldview. The humanists have taught you that the origin of the universe is self-existent and not created. So that's what the humanists believe. That's what most of our culture believes. That's what's been ingrained in our culture. That's what's been taught to our culture, that the origin of the universe is self-existent and not created. That the origin of man, this is what they taught you, that the origin of man is part of nature and that it has emerged as a result of a continuous process. And then consciousness. What's the origin of consciousness? How can you, if you don't have duality, how can you explain the consciousness? Holding the organic view of life, humanists find the traditional dualism of mind and body must be rejected. So if you're rejecting that, that's what Dr. Meyer is talking about here. That those are the three big questions that establish materialism.
Blame.
You got to deliver the goods.
Yes.
In the interview with you, it was so telling. When you asked him what he wished he knew and could explain, he said, the origin of the universe, the origin of life, and the nature of consciousness.
Yeah.
Well, those are the very things that materialism, it's not just that science can't explain those, a materialistic worldview fails to explain those.
And actually, a belief in God is, in a way, endorsed by those big questions, because the human brain cannot come up with any other logical explanation. So a logical explanation based on science and data, it doesn't exist.
And this is not God of the gaps, okay? There are gaps there for materialism, but the materialists assume that any explanation that doesn't involve a purely material
absolutely
process is an explanation that is just filling a mere gap.
Absolutely, and that's why they sold you the chemical imbalance, that you're depressed because you have a chemical imbalance. If you're only a physical being that has come about through a natural process, then there has to be some, if you're depressed or you have some spiritual ailment because you don't have a soul, then there has to be something physical in your physiology that needs to be repaired to repair what's going on in your brain. So that's why they sold you the chemical imbalance. Take these drugs, and that drugs will repair the chemical imbalance, and then you can have a peaceful mind again. It's all based on lies.
Is an explanation that is just filling a mere gap. But the rules of explanation are a little different than that. A good explanation provides a causally adequate explanation where you infer an entity which, if true, would be capable of generating and therefore explaining the thing of interest. We look at the origin of the universe and we understand that matter, space, time, and energy come into existence. Then prior to that, there's no matter again to do the causing. So materialistic explanations are inherently inadequate, and yet positing an external entity that has volition and agency does fit the bill.
It absolutely does.
That would provide a positive explanation.
So here's the tough question.
Absolutely does.
Some of my family members have renounced their faith.
All right, so I want to get into this article that I didn't get a chance to read in the last podcast. I mean, I can do hours on this topic. But I'm going to read this article, and we may get back into this topic in another podcast. Again, this was an article that was written in 2008, December of 2008, roughly 2009. And it was written in the Times by an atheist by the name of Matthew Paris is his name. And the title of the article is, "As an Atheist, I Truly Believe Africa Needs God." And the subtitle is, "Missionaries, Not Aid, Are the Solution to Africa's Biggest Problem, the crushing passivity of people's mindset." All right. So here's the article. I'm going to pick it up in the third paragraph. On the first two paragraphs, he talks about how he, as a boy, lived in Africa, in Malawi. And he went back to Malawi to observe a NGO that helped African villages dig wells, and it's called Pump Aid. And then he goes into how he observed something while he was on this trip in Africa that he has been unable to shake ever since he was a child. We'll read this last sentence in the second paragraph and then go from there. "It confounds my ideological beliefs, stubbornly refuses to fit in my worldview." Again, he's an atheist. He says it next paragraph. "And has embarrassed my growing belief that there is no God. Now a confirmed atheist, I've become convinced that the enormous contributions that Christian evangelism makes in Africa, sharply distinct from the work of secular NGOs, government projects, and international aid efforts. These alone will not do. Education and training alone will not do. In Africa, Christianity changes people's hearts." And heart is synonymous with mind. When you hear people talk about hearts, heart is mind. They're not talking about your beating heart. They're talking about your mind. So in Africa, Christianity changes people's hearts. It brings a spiritual transformation. The rebirth is real. The change is good. I used to avoid this truth by applauding, as you can, the practical work of mission churches in Africa. It's a pity, I would say, that salvation is part of the package. Listen to that. It's a pity that salvation is part of the package. But Christians, black and white, working in Africa, do heal the sick, do teach people to read and write, and only the severest kind of secularist could see a mission hospital or school and say that the world would be better off without it. I would allow that faith was needed to motivate missionaries to help, then fine. But what counted was the help, not the faith. That's what he says that he used to say. But this does not fit the facts. Faith does more than support the missionary. It is also transferred to the flock. This is the effect that matters so immensely and which I cannot help observing. First, then, the observation. We had friends who were missionaries. As a child, I stayed with them often. I also stayed alone with my little brother in a traditional rural African village. In the city we had working for us Africans who had converted and were strong believers. The Christians were also always different, from having cowed or confined its converts. Far from having cowed or confined its converts, the faith appeared to have liberated and relaxed them. The faith that so this is what he noticed. He noticed that the Christian converts in Africa were different, that they weren't cowering and cowed, that the faith had appeared to liberate them and relax them. And we're talking about a peaceful mind again. There was a liveliness, a curiosity and engagement in the world, a directness in their dealings with others that seemed to be missing in traditional African life. They stood tall. At 24, traveling by land across the continent reinforced this impression. From Algiers to Nigeria, to Cameroon, to Central African Republic, then right through the Congo to Rwanda, Tanzania, and Kenya. Four student friends and I drove our old Land Rover to Nairobi. We slept under the stars, so it was important as we reached more populated, lawless parts of the sub-Sahara that every day we found somewhere safe by nightfall, often near a mission. Whenever we entered the territory worked by missionaries, we had to acknowledge that something changed in the faces of the people we passed and spoke to, something in their eyes, the way that they approach you direct, man to man, without looking down. They had not become more deferential towards strangers, but in some ways less so, and but more open. All right. I'm not going to be able to read the rest of this. I've already gone over. You guys, I'm going to put this, all right, I put it in the show note, this article in the show notes in the last podcast. I'll put it in the show notes in this podcast, but you get the point of where this article is going and how it reinforces everything that I have been telling you. All right, so I'll see you guys on Friday. I hope that you enjoyed the podcast, and we're going to pick up on Friday, depending on what happens this week. Hope you guys have a great week. But if we can, we're going to get into the protests, and we're going to talk about politics in a little bit. Thank you guys for listening, and I will see you guys on Friday.